Galaxy Quest.
Galaxy Quest.
Oh, all right. Good morning. Welcome. You will have your first quiz today, but it'll be at the end of class. So I'll pass it out. It works, believe me. So I'll pass it out in about 35 minutes or so. And it's only 5 questions. I don't think it'll take you long. But as soon as you're done, just turn it in and take off for the weekend. So my only assignment then for Monday is no new assignment. Just make sure you've read Crito. That's what we're going to go over. So that's a really important document. We've got to spend a little bit of time on that and also on the development of philosophy. What I'd like to do today is,
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem. I don't think we'll get to it today because I want to talk a little bit about some pre-Socratic stuff before we get to it. But I hope by Monday. It just depends how long-winded I am today and how many questions you guys have. So, okay, what I want to do today, we're going to kind of divide the Greeks and the importance of the Greeks for us into two parts, as I mentioned the other day. So patriotism, kind of an understanding of what is the West, and then we also have to do philosophy. We have to look at what philosophy is, and we have to figure out what it is. It's not an easy concept, but it's a very interesting one. And I want to give a little bit of background on that. But again, that'll probably be Monday. So I want to focus on the patriotism. So when I left you on Wednesday, we were just talking about the significance of this battle, the Battle of Thermopylae, which, in terms of numbers, there are very few people involved, at least on our side. There are only 300 who are involved. And yet, despite that, the same thing we'll see at, for example, the Battle of the Alamo, where you have 187. These things take on a life of their own. So even though we may be talking about few numbers killed, we're talking about significant moments. And in a sense, the fact that we have fewer numbers kind of gives us a greater mythic understanding of the importance of those battles. So people actually count, right? That they're not just one of a billion, but we've actually got a number that we can get our mind around. It's pretty hard for any of us in this room to imagine 100,000 people congregated together. I mean, our minds will allow it, but to actually think of the 100,000 various people around would be hard. It's not as hard for us to think of 300 or 187. Those are things we can imagine at your freshman class that came in. It's just a little over 300. So we're talking about essentially one class, one grade level here at Hillsdale who disappeared there at the Battle of Thermopylae. But I want to talk a little bit about what the patriotism means and how it plays out. So you had two very brief historical accounts of different kinds of understandings, two really, one a dialogue, the other a monologue, where we have all of those Persians talking in Herodotus, and then we have Pericles talking in Thucydides. So these two guys, you do need to know, so Pericles you need to know as well, but I want you to know the authors here, Herodotus and Thucydides. We don't have time in this class to go into great detail about them, but we should know a little bit. So these are the two first historians in the West. So of the Occident, these are it. Herodotus is the first to write, and he writes right after the Persian Wars. So a lot of what he's trying to do is to define, in the way that Homer had done it heroically, he's trying to define Westernness or Greekness based on the idea of sacrifice. So especially sacrifice that we saw at places like Thermopylae or the Battle of Marathon. These kinds of things represent what he sees as the best of Greekness, Hellas, or ultimately Westernness. So what Herodotus does, and really these two ways of thinking about history are still the ways we do it today. One always is kind of superior over the other in terms of what's in favor and what's not. Herodotus's idea of history is that if you tell him a story, he takes it seriously and he writes it down. So if one of you give me a story, and in that story you talk about how maybe some tree spirits spoke to you on the way to class this morning, Herodotus doesn't discount that. He just says, yeah, okay, maybe that's not true, but what he writes down is what you told him. So he writes down in a mythic way. That is, he's willing to bring the supernatural into things. Thucydides offers what we would consider a much more objective scientific approach. So if someone tells him a story, he will take it apart in his mind rationally. So if they're tree spirits, that's impossible. So he leaves that part of the story out. Or he may say something like, this man who told me this story had a mental problem and went off into a fancy, but wouldn't describe what it is. So these are the two ways that we see history being written. One, we just take whatever someone tells us and we write it down and we take it seriously. The other, we use our rationality and parse things out and try and take out what seems unbelievable. So Herodotus would be more mythic, and Thucydides would be more objective in the way that they approach things. But I want to talk about what that actually means, how we read them. So, yeah, Lionel.
Thucydides even mentioned the tree spirits. Would he go, this person told me about tree spirits, but it was probably this?
In his mind, he's probably thinking it's false, but he writes it down anyway. So, that, I'm sorry, did you say Herodotus or Thucydides?
No, Thucydides.
Yeah, Thucydides, he might write it down, but the chances aren't good. So when you read, and here's the difference, when you read Herodotus, that the irony is Thucydides, by trying to be objective, actually makes it all about Thucydides. That's the problem, right? Whereas Herodotus is warm. It's not about Herodotus, because Herodotus is willing to listen to you. And so it may be that Thucydides is more scientifically accurate, but he's as dry as all get out, because it's all based on him. So it's all his standard.
I guess as the Greeks continued and you get into the Romans, what kind of pattern did people try to follow Thucydides as an example?
Yeah, they're a little bit different, and we will get into this. So we're going to look at various theories of history. The next major theory of history we'll see is the one, and you guys don't need to write this down yet, but it's the one that we'll see coming out of Livy at the fall of Republican Rome. So it really, in terms of historians, it goes Herodotus, Thucydides, Livy, and then St. Augustine. And what Livy doesn't really, he does take seriously the gods or the god. He has no problem with it. He says, look, it may or may not be true, but even if it's not true, it tells us something significant, in the same way that there are probably some people in this room who read Genesis literally and others who read it just symbolically. We can do both. And Livy says, look, even if we only read it symbolically, it's still telling us something important. Even if we don't believe God actually did that, the fact they believe God did that matters. But what happens when you get to Livy and the Romans, they see all of history as just decline. Everything in history is, you start out well, and we just get worse and worse. That's what history is. History is just us. It's the fall of the Republic and the bleeding into the empire. History is great institutions that fall apart through man's weaknesses, and then we're all dead. That's kind of the Livy perspective. So does that help? Okay, but we'll get to that, I promise. Yeah.
Did these guys...
No, that's okay.
But did these two people, did they like compete against each other or right at the same time?
No, not at all. They're at different parts of the century.
Okay.
So Herodotus is at the beginning of the 5th century BC. Okay. Thucydides is at the end.
Okay.
So they're writing about two different time periods, same century,
but
two different. Yeah, it's a great question. Okay, so Herodotus then, you guys have this dialogue, and we're going to get to it in just a moment and talk about what it means. But I want to read just a bit, and I love Herodotus. It's so fun. This is one of those great books that actually it's not dry at all. When you start it, you really can't put it down. It's just one great story after another. How much of it's true? Who knows? But it's still a lot of fun. So he starts off, not surprisingly, he starts off the book. You don't have this in your reading. This is a huge book. You guys have, what, four paragraphs or something from this huge book. And you have the most bizarre part, because the whole book's about the Greeks. So why we pick the part about the Persians, I want you to think of it. It does matter. But why do we take the one tiny part about the Persians? Usually the Persians are just the evil bad guys we want to kill. Here, they're actually interesting. So, yeah, Kim.
Was it because they were specifically discussing what kind of government seems best, and it wasn't the Greeks,
yeah,
but one of them was kind of expressing a Western viewpoint?
Keep that in mind. We'll get to that in just a bit, right? And we'll talk about that. Okay, so here's what he says, trying to define then what is the human person. And I love this. You don't need to write this down, but I just want you to think about how he understands this, right? This question we're always going to ask, especially the Greeks, what is man? What is man? What is woman? So what do we find? We find that when we look at the sum of an average lived person, that all of these days, usually about 70 years, so that's a pretty good lifespan at the time, and in Greece, because of things we talked about, Soren the other day, things like wine and olive oil and bread, they're able to have a high caloric intake, much higher than the rest of Europe, certainly in Africa. So people are living about 70 years. That's really good. We're not going to retain, we're not going to get back to that for a long time. So all of these days of 70 years add up to 26,250 days total. Now just imagine that for a moment. Think about your life divided by days. Imagine that you've only got roughly 27,000 days. That's it. And so what does that mean? It says, well, if we have this, we must understand something. That is, human life and its creation seems purely chance. So here it comes, it arrives, and there it is. But once you understand its chance, then you have to understand this. Out of those almost 27,000 days, not a single day is identical to any other day. That's Herodotus. So every day brings with it something completely unlike any other day. So what does that mean? One person's wealthy. Maybe one person rules over a lot of people. I cannot tell you how your life will end, even if you are wealthy and you have power. You see, the man who is very wealthy is no happier or prosperous than the man who has only enough to live day by day, unless good fortune stays with him and he retains his fair and noble possessions right up until he departs this life. For many wealthy people are unhappy, while many others who have more modest resources are quite happy. The man who has great wealth but is unhappy outdoes the fortunate man in only two ways, while the fortunate man outdoes him in almost every way. The former is more capable of gratifying his immediate passions and of sustaining himself even in adversity. But the happy, only well-off man, not the rich man, but the well-off man, although he does not have the same ability to sustain himself in adversity or passion, avoids both of these as extremes and lives moderately towards the good. Moreover, if he has no injury, no sickness, no painful experience, what does he have? He has good children. And if you have good children and you die, this is the only thing we would say that makes a man blessed. So I don't think we have to agree with all that, but I love his understanding. Right? We've only got this limited number of days, and yet those days he gives us are much greater than what we see in most of the world. So we only have a limited number of days. Every day is unlike the other. And what's our goal? Our goal is not to have goods, it's to live for the good. And that's what we have to do, as he says. So everything, and we're going to get into this in just a moment, everything for Herodotus comes down to living out a life of virtue. What is virtue, right? That question. Now, the Greeks do not actually have a word that means virtue, which is bizarre. Right? We have to use the Latin, virtu, virtue. And there is no Greek word for it. The Greeks have words for success and competition, like arete, but it doesn't mean quite the same thing. Even though they have the concept of virtue, they don't have a word for it. That's fascinating. So we've got to think about, well, how can they have this concept without a word, and what does it mean? So life is not about possessions, it's not about success, it's not about glory, and it's not about power. It's about making good moral choices. That's what life is. And you can be poor and yet end beautifully, and you can be rich and end horribly. So it has nothing to do with wealth. It has everything to do with your soul. How is your soul ordered? Is it ordered towards the good or is it not? So you've all heard this already in your time at Hillsdale. Not just the virtues, but pursuit of the good, the true, and the beautiful. Herodotus is the first to bring up these ideas in ways that we can start comprehending. Not like the Jews. The Jews, remember, are a chosen people. The rules are very specific to them. But now we're starting to see these universal concepts, not just for the Greeks, but for everybody, the human person. How do we define this? Okay, I saw a couple of hands. So, yes?
No, just talking about how the Greeks don't have a word for virtue, I just wondered in general, in like the early ages, if you will, when all these people were like kind of beginning, more or less, based on the words that they have or don't have, does it play into like who they are as a society? Like the Greeks have words for like competition and winning, right, and like being ahead, and those are the, like, those matter in some,
yes,
way. But then they don't have a word for virtue, so they're not. Does that mean, like, can you infer from that that they're not as they're not as concerned with like who they are as a people, but like what they're gaining?
Well, so think about this: with when we think about someone like Pericles. Mm-hmm. That Pericles is not high in his thought like Herodotus, right? Herodotus is thinking about what is man, what is the good and the true. Whereas Pericles is saying, let's take that to an immediate level.
Yeah.
When you go into this situation, do you act this way or this way?
Yeah.
Right? So it's still the same, but it's much more immediate for the Greek population. So the idea of the high, that is the good, the true, and the beautiful, is really only among a few Greek intellectuals.
Yeah.
It's not among the whole population. So... okay,
yep,
good.
That makes sense. Yeah, thank you.
Good. Kenna.
I just wanted to check on the days again. How many was it? Like 20? Mm. That just kind of...
He says roughly 70 years, and that ends up being between about 26,000 and 27,000. If we take it a little bit further, I mean, he's not quite accurate about that, in part because the day is a little bit different for him, but it's close, right? It's not that far off. I calculated it once. I think the average male in America, I didn't do women, but the average male in America, I think, lives 31,000 days. So if I remember, I have to look it up, but I did calculate it after reading that. So by our understanding of days, and yeah.
And I had another random question, but it can wait till after class.
Cause no, that's okay. Go ahead.
It was from an external reading, so it's not...
Oh, okay, yeah, we'll talk later then. Good. Yeah. Lionel.
It'd be the Greeks didn't have a word for virtue because they didn't want to identify something wrongly.
That's possible. That's a great question because a lot of times we'll see that when there are things that are just taken for granted in a society, there's no need for a definition. In fact, some people have argued that we only define things philosophically until there's a problem. Right, so we react when something's missing, then we have to define it. So it's a great question. I don't have an answer for that specifically about the Greeks, but that'll be a question we bring up throughout the course, definitely. And especially in the second half of this course, when you get to American heritage, this is a huge debate about rights. Do you define what a right is, or do you just define what the rights are, or do you just accept they exist? It's a similar thing to virtue. Yeah, absolutely. Shelby.
So I was thinking about Aristotle's ethics.
Yeah.
There's good. A whole part where he talks about how, like, after we die, like, our whether or not our, like, children remember us, mm-hmm. that has, like, how big of a part does that play in happiness? And I remember being like, that
right.
doesn't really matter at all, like, whether or not a person's happy, because I feel like probably Americans are a lot less concerned with, like, their legacy than mm-hmm. Greeks were.
Right.
But I was wondering if maybe that's just, like, a Greek understanding of virtue,
yeah.
because... or them trying to get at this idea of, like, virtue being an eternal thing
yeah.
as opposed to, like, an immediate thing?
Yes. No, it's a great question, Shelby. And the Crito is dealing with this to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Right? What defines moral goodness, and what can we define ourselves in the end? And, of course, Socrates, you know, not to give too much away yet, but the reason Socrates accepts the hemlock is not because the law at the moment is just, but the community over time is just, right? So even though the community now is doing something stupid, the community as a whole is a good. And to upset that is a very difficult thing. And to do, it's not clear that Socrates has the right to upset the whole community, even if it's making a bad transition, because he doesn't see community as today. He sees it as past, present, and future. And in that sense, it does matter what you do, because you have to live up to what your grandparents did. You have to pass that on to your grandchildren. That's happiness. Mm-hmm. It's not, happiness isn't being joyous. It's being satisfied. It's being God at the end of creation looking back and saying, yeah, it's good. Yeah, there's a satisfaction there. It's not like God has lots of stuff suddenly. He's like, yes, right? It's more that he knows what he's done has been good. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's just at the end of a life, that's how we should be as well. Does that
yeah.
help? Okay, good. Anybody else on this? I saw a few of their hands. Okay, so now I want to get back to this question. You've read this dialogue here. You have this intense, one of the first political, philosophical dialogues ever in history, where these guys are sitting around, these Persians are sitting around, and they're talking about the best form of government. And of course, what do they break it down to? What are the three parts?
Democracy.
Yep.
And
Okay, those are the bad, right? Those are the bad forms. So the bad forms are essentially tyranny, right? When the executive has gone bad, oligarchy, when the aristocracy has gone bad, and democracy, when the people have gone bad. Those are the bad terms, but they work equally if we look at it on the good side. So here we would just say monarch, aristocracy, and people. Remember, Demos is a god of chaos. So democracy, when you say democracy from Demos, you're saying basically chaos. We can talk about what that means. That's different in the Greek understanding from the way we would think of the rule of the people. So yeah, Bryson.
When I read that, I felt like there was even a fourth one in there. And I would.
And what is that?
Just pure free. Like, yeah. Tanish is really big on, yep. Like, I'm going to have no part of this, and
right.
You guys are going to have no part of me.
Right.
He's so, the only one who really comes out, I think, on top at the end of this.
So let's think about that. What would we call that? You said free. Is a form of government?
Anarchy.
Absolutely.
Who doesn't know what you're saying democracy is?
Dr. Brady.
So anarchy is without government, right? This is what he's getting at. Yeah.
Kenna. I was going to ask, would it be in his own perspective, because he wanted to separate himself because he wasn't wanting to be ruled, would it be self-government on the good side and anarchy on this bad side?
Nope. Anarchy. Anarchy. We have made anarchy a bad thing. Anarchy now means bomb-throwing idiot. That's not what it meant at the time. Anarchy in the Greek only meant without government. Okay. So you could say self-government as well. There's another term for that. But yeah, and that's the interesting thing. We can find contrast to each of these. But remember, Otanes is what? How many people follow his example?
His family.
That's it. Yeah. And we don't know how long. We only know that when Herodotus writes this, his family's still free. That means they've been free for maybe a generation. So there's no Otanes running around now. Actually, there may be a lot of them. But you know, they're tribal. They're not anarchists. They are the bomb throwers. So there are people without government, but Otanes and his family is gone. But that's what makes him interesting, because we have all these counterparts. Then you get to him, there's no counterpart. But partly there's no counterpart because this is a one-time thing that's going to happen. It's not the norm, whereas these others could be the norm. Lionel.
So reading this is the same way it was like reading the first part of Samuel.
Yeah.
The libertarian jumps out at me because when these people were defending whatever they wanted to defend, either be the monarch or the aristocracy, they didn't defend it by exalting that. They defended it by ruining the other two.
Yes, absolutely.
And no one had a positive thing to say about anything.
That's right. So we're focused much more on, geez, what are we left with? Yeah. Right? We're left with one of these things. Yeah, that's exact. And when we get to Plato and Aristotle, it'll be very different because then they're positives for the most part. Not all, but they'll explain, this is the gift of this, this is the gift of that. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. These are negatives. Okay, good. Yeah, Soren.
Leo, you brought up that question, right, about like the difference between anarchy and democracy. Some, whatever that question was that was just asked, that is a question I've been asking since I read it and have talked about it with people and cannot reach a decision.
Okay.
I feel like... What's his name? Otanes.
Otanes. Yeah, Otanes.
Otanes. I feel like Otanes, I don't know, I've read where he pulls himself out of the society, and I just was like, dude, what are you doing? Why would you do that? Because he's fighting for democracy, and then I feel like he does the least democratic thing possible. So my question is, does what you said about democracy being this idea of chaos... Is it actually that when he talks about democracy, it's not democracy in my mind, which is ruled truly by the people. He's talking about more of an anarchy, like everyone...
Mob rule.
Yeah, like like an everyone does...
Yeah, mobocracy, right.
Okay,
right.
So it is that. So I had a wrong...
But do remember, I mean, this is really important. Demos is not a good god. So when you take the name Demos for your word, democracy, that's bad. That would be like Satanocracy for us, right? I mean, that's how bad it is. So yeah, these are not good guys. They're worse gods, like Whirl. He's worse. And Phobos. But Demos is bad. So to put that on with this is fascinating.
But it's not democracy as I would understand democracy. It's another definite...
It's not the way we use it loosely now, is kind of anybody who's not in chains, right? We kind of use it now as, oh, the democracies, the democratic powers. But we use it so loosely now, too. It doesn't mean much, except it's kind of a feel-good term.
Okay.
We prefer people to be in a democracy than anything else, but we don't define it. And what we'll see here, this is to me, this is fascinating, especially, and I'm with you in this, even though I'm a lot older than you guys. We all grew up with this, where democracy is a good thing. For most of Western history, democracy has been a terrible curse. The idea that the people would run wild and do whatever they wanted. That, I mean, it's what we would call anarchy. Those terms have been kind of reversed, though. Democracy, up until even at the time of, say, Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, if you called someone a Democrat, small d, there was no Democratic Party yet, if you called someone a Democrat, you're calling them an animal. You're calling them an agent of chaos. And that's a huge, you can duel, you can die saying so. That's insulting somebody, seriously. So it only is in the 1820s that we start looking at democracy as a good thing. Is that, I hope that helps.
Yeah.
But it'll be hard to understand a lot of political thought if we don't understand nobody's pro-democratic, okay, except really crazy radicals. Okay. A few in the Reformation, a few in the Renaissance, but they're rare.
So the fact that he then removed himself from society, it wasn't actually he wanted to see this free people come about. It was more of like, I don't want to have to deal with you guys.
I think he's basically saying, you guys aren't going to go anywhere with this. I'm out of here.
Okay.
He gave up. Yeah. It doesn't mean he's wrong.
I still don't like his...
Oh, I think he's hilarious. But, he is exactly Henry David Thoreau.
Yes.
Right? I mean, that's what he... So.
Right, but if he wants to have a say in how the culture runs...
But he doesn't. He only wants to protect his family.
Okay.
That's all he cares about.
Okay, then that's where he and I have different values then.
Yeah. No, understood, right? There's no right answer on this.
Okay.
These are very debatable questions, certainly. And we don't hear from Otanes anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's not like he makes a mark on history. That was his one thing.
Right.
His one thing was withdrawing from everything. So, yeah, Bryson.
I mean, kind of to like talk to that question just a little bit, even between the differences of democracy and anarchy, although like it seems like he's going anarchy, in my mind, I think he's doing something really clever here, and he's putting himself in the same power as kings. He's basically saying kings have no control over him.
He's the king of his own kingdom.
And not just doing that, he's securing power for his entire family, not just one person, whereas their power can go away and leave. He's saying, I'll never be ruled by you, and you'll always have to talk to me like an equal, like a noble. I think he's doing something much more clever than maybe just choosing not to be a part of society, because it's not like he's leaving society. He's still being there, but now he's got the power to do whatever he wants.
Okay.
Now, this is fascinating, because when we get to the medieval period, we often think of the medieval period as ruled by kings. It's not. It's a bunch of Otanes running around. And some of them are Catholics, some of them are not, some of them are monks or this order, someone has a barony here and a duchy here, and it basically, the medieval period is not held together by politics, it's held together by culture. And that's a very similar thing. That's where I think, I do think Bryson's right, that we have to take Otanes seriously. We don't have to agree with him, but he is doing something that it does have a profound significance at some level.
Okay.
Right? But he's not Greek, obviously. Right, that's the exact opposite of Socrates.
Right,
they are exactly opposite in every way. So, okay, yes. Carly. Yes, in my head, I keep wanting to call you Colby, and
Colby.
Believe me, you don't look like a boy. But for some reason, Colby pops into my head. So, Carly, please.
All right, thank you. So, there's one quote that really stood out to me. It was very prophetic. This is on page 69. It was straight away the author of so great a service is admired by all. Speaking of monarchy, why democracy would never work. Basically, he's saying that straight away the author of so great a service, so someone that tried to create a democratic nation, is admired by all, and from being admired, soon comes to be appointed king. So that here, too, it is plain that monarchy is the best government.
Mm-hmm.
I found that so interesting, because the way that we were able to have a successful democracy is because of the sacrifice of George Washington.
Yep.
And there have been like numerous men in history that have proven wrong, from Cincinnatus to...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So there is that. And of course, remember, all of those guys are Republicans, too. And that's they don't choose a form of government. They choose all three. Republicanism, in some ways, is exactly the opposite of anarchy. Because rather than choosing monarchy, aristocracy, or the people, you have all three in a republic. That's a huge difference, right? That's huge. So this really matters, and it matters that Washington was there in his time, no question. Is it Anne? I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah, thank you.
I got, so talking about the difference between Greece and the Persians and like the God King versus mm-hmm. freedom, I really noticed how the last sentence of this dialogue, it says, Artanes continues to be the only free family in Persia. Those who belong to it submit to the rule of the king only so far as they themselves choose. They are bound, however, to observe the laws of the land, like other Persians. So essentially, all the Greeks were expected to do was follow the laws, and the king was still bound to that. Whereas the Persians have this, like, the king, and you have to follow his whims.
Yep.
So it's like St. Otanes became, like, the Greek's ideal, and then he just had to follow the laws. I think that was kind of interesting.
It is fascinating. I agree. Yeah. Leo, do you have your hand up?
Oh, no, I'm sure.
Okay, that's okay. I'm gonna just take Shelby, because you guys have spoken, and then I want to end this. We've got two things I want to bring up. So Shelby, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask my question from a few days ago about, because he's talking, when he talks about democracy, or, like, why democracy wouldn't work, he says it's because, like, the rabble's untaught and has no natural sense of what is right and fit. And so does that mean that he's implying that, like, the monarchy would have a mm-hmm. natural sense? And is that, like, a blessing, is that, like, a good breeding thing, or is that an education thing, or is that like a sign of God on the monarchy?
It could be all of the above.
Okay.
Yeah, and it could be a combination of one or two of those as well. So there are a lot of different defenses of why monarch, but certainly you can see if we do take seriously, and this the Greeks agree, the Greeks definitely agree there are three parts of government. Mm-hmm. That's without question. They are there. The question is, which do you emphasize, or how do you combine them? So it's not a question of whether or not there are other forms, which is what makes anarchy so fascinating, because it doesn't have its counterpart, and it really doesn't fit, except it's not like anything else. And so these things are all true. What you're suggesting, Shelby, and this is a problem, we'll see it all through the Western tradition, what do we have? Well, if a monarch rules well, there's no problem with a monarch, right? If a democracy rules well, there's no problem. The problem is all of these forms go corrupt very, very quickly. So how do you present one? And that's where a republic is the most fragile of all governments, always. But in many ways, it's the most beautiful, too, because it's trying to balance three natural parts rather than emphasizing one over the other. So that's what makes it fascinating. And I will admit, of all my biases in here, I mean, I'm a hardcore small-R Republican. I love republics. And you guys, for better or worse, you're going to get that this semester. But I think that's part of what the Greeks are doing here. Okay, so two things I want to end with today. So, you guys, great discussion. I'm sorry to close it off. It's just time is limited, and we've got to move on a little bit. But I love your energy. It means everything to me. So I'm sorry to close it off. But two things we have to do. Okay, number one, and Kenna had brought this up a little bit earlier, and maybe I'll modify it just a bit. One of the most interesting things about Herodotus, including this dialogue, and with the Persians, so the Persians are always the bad guys. Here, though, they're not. They're interesting. They're filled out. They're fleshed out. They're real characters. And what do we see? This is the importance of this. It's not important what any one of these guys is arguing. We're going to see better arguments for each of those things from Aristotle. Right? They're starting. And Herodotus is obviously starting. We don't even know if these guys ever had this conversation. Herodotus could be totally making this up. But notice what happens here. The Persians had been brought up never to think for themselves, ever. The Persians are to follow the God King. No limitations to that. No caveats, nothing. So the very fact you've got these Persians arguing about various forms of government shows the superiority of Greek freedom. Because the Greeks talk about anything, and that's a part of their freedom. This is an argument for free speech. So by just allowing people to talk about this, you're automatically giving a form of creativity, and creativity is always associated with freedom. So the Persians were not creative. They were obedient. Now we get to the Greeks, and the Greeks have infected them with freedom, which is exactly what the Persians feared. That's why they attacked them. That's why they wanted to kill him. So this is what's important about that. All right, does that make sense? Okay, so it's the spreading of ideas. Second thing, and I'm not going to have time to do this today, but I do want you to at least write these down now, and we'll come back to them immediately on Monday. The Greeks don't have a definition of virtue, but they have four virtues. And those four virtues are to this day. And you have to, in this class, there will be seven overall, and then they're actually 10 because the Romans have 3. You will have to, for me, quizzes, everything, not today's, but every quiz from here on out, every test, you have to know these. You have to memorize these. So 4 terms I'm going to give you now, and then I'll define them on Monday. But I want you to know them. They are in this order: prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. So the Greeks, the first time we ever see this formulation of the 4 is in a Platonic dialogue called the Symposium. And it's kind of a weird dialogue, frankly, because it deals with a lot of weird stuff. But in that dialogue, one of the key figures says, well, we all agree these are the 4 virtues. And you know, if there's no argument in the Socratic dialogue, that's what everybody believes. They don't even discuss it. They all just agree. Okay, prudence, justice, temperance, fortitude. There it is. And they've got it. So we'll come back to that, but you guys have to know those, because that's to understand how to pursue the good, the true, and the beautiful. These are the routes we take to get there. Okay? Lionel, last point.
It just, so you said the order is specific.
Yes.
So that means there's a hierarchy here.
Yes.
And I just am confused as why prudence would outweigh justice.
Ah, because prudence is the ability to discern good from evil. And if you can't do that, you can't do anything else. That's why it's the first of all virtues. It's also why pride is the greatest of sins. Because pride is about focusing on the self.
So prudence would actually be the biblical's counterpart to wisdom. Wisdom as given to
someone. Oh, prudence and wisdom are almost identical. Yeah, not exactly, because wisdom in the Old Testament comes across much more as a kind of a character. Like wisdom, especially in Solomon, right? It's almost as though it's a goddess or an angelic power. I'm not exaggerating, but whereas here it's definitely a human thing. Okay, guys, first thing you got to do, I think I've got exactly if everybody showed up today. Shannon, feel free to. Shannon is excused because he had, I don't know, I have to go into detail. Shannon missed the first 2 days of class. He can share with you his bodily ills if he wants, but for right now, let him go. So feel free to take off, Shannon. Thank you. So everybody, just make sure, Shannon, don't worry about it. That was just for me. So don't worry about it. Just put your name on at the top right away, and you just have 5 questions. That's it. Answer those and turn them in. As soon as you turn them in, you're welcome to take off. I'll see you guys. I hope you have a great weekend. It's cooler.
We don't have enough.
Oh. Dr. Bird, can you go with Christopher or someone?
Sir, please. That's how I know. Who needs one? Okay, sorry, guys. See you, Shannon. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, you too.
Yeah, that's exactly right, sir. Yes. What's that? You can, but I really, you just need to answer the best one.